Song of Solomon chapter 3. Song of Solomon chapter 3 begins with verse 1. Again, we still got the bride, and now she is engaged in daydreaming about, you know, what she's going to do. We got the situation here that she's in the palace of Solomon. Solomon is trying to woo her, and she wants nothing to do with him. Nice guy, but I've got my heart set on another. So it says, on my bed, night after night, I sought him, whom my soul loves. It's the second time we've seen this phrase, my soul loves. And of course, as you know, in the doctrine of marriage, we also have a little section in there on the doctrine of dating, because there's lots of people that you can be attracted to in the dating process for you, those of you who are still single out here. And I recall those days myself. And you can share many things in common with other members of the opposite sex. So that's the first stage of dating, is attraction, because why would you date someone that you're not attracted to or go out on a date with? Normal people are attracted, and they attractive about something, and so it could be their intellect, it could be the physical part, it could be both. It could be just, you know, they share certain ideas about things or whatever it is, something clicks, so you have the attraction phase. And that can be pretty intense sometimes. And then the second phase, of course, is the compatibility stage, where you kind of determine, are we compatible? Do we like the same things? And what's the wide range of interests that we share, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you have norms in your soul, like you adhere to the divine institutions and they don't, you ain't compatible. You're attracted, but you're not compatible. And there you've got a conflict right there. And that tells you it's time to, as we say in the military, E&E, which is escape and evade. But see, some people get married during the attraction stage, and then they find out, the compatibility stage is now, we're in that stage, and boy, I don't really like this person very much, but now I'm married. Oops. So the attractiveness stuff can wear off, and now the compatibility, it turns to bitterness and just all sorts of wonderful things. But the third stage, we're assuming you're not getting married in the attractive stage or the compatibility stage. You want to wait, ideally, to the third stage, which is the rapport stage. You actually identify that person as, this is, with all their faults and flaws and my faults and flaws, this seems like the person that was designed for me. And if you're a believer, it'll dawn on you. It'll dawn on you. If you're an unbeliever, well, you're probably going to get married in the compatibility stage, because unbelievers can get married. They can find happiness in the institution of marriage. Remember, it's a divine institution. But for a believer, you better make sure that you're very careful about going through all three stages and identifying that this is the person that God designed for me a long time ago, and that might be the third marriage that you're going into, because you might have had some flops during 1 and 2, which is okay. I mean, it's just reality. And you might, God in his grace, of course, bailed you out because he knew you'd be an idiot in 1, and let's just say they only got to 2. We won't say they went to 5 before they figured it out, because sometimes they never figure it out. And they keep repeating the same problem. I'm dating the same idiot I dated before, just a different set of genes. But the same thing, I'm attracted to him, and somehow I fall into the same thing. And you're cycling these things. Psychologists have all sorts of BS things about how this stuff happens, but we look what the Bible says. So Solomon was clearly in the attraction stage, but God also let him kind of fast forward to the rapport stage. I mean, he liked this woman, but she didn't, again, he had not fulfilled the conditions of the escrow, whatever it was. This was the right woman for him. This is the one that he should have had, that he could have had, except he did it to himself, and he never filled that void in his portfolio. It was a big blot out on the marriage thing. And of course, when he was an old man, he substituted Bible doctrine for his deficiencies, and that bailed him out at the end. So that's where we're at. We're at the, you know, she has identified that she's at the rapport stage with this individual my soul loves. This tells you she's at the rapport stage. If it was my eyes love, you're at the attraction stage. She's at the final stage, and she's ready to get married. So on my bed, night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. Third time. I sought him but did not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me. And I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves. Fourth time. Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. Again, I held on to him and would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. Again, she is not a wealthy person. She's still living with her mother. And, maybe it's a four-room, three-room, two-room, you know, one room for the cooking and the living room and one room for a bedroom, maybe another bedroom. This also reminds me of just how females are wired. Remember Mary Magdalene? That's the first thing she did when she saw the resurrected Christ. She grabbed him. I held on to him, would not let him go. Put him in a bear hug. And Mary Magdalene, of course, was a former prostitute. And she was the one that saw Jesus first in his resurrection body. Why? And this is another indication that the Gospels are true, because you would never admit that a woman ousted a man. You know, if you're going to write a narrative, you wouldn't put the woman, a former prostitute, as the one that saw the Lord first, or the other ladies that saw him first. It would be the men. But see, that's an indication that the Gospels are true in what they recorded, because this would never be recorded if you're writing a story, because people would automatically say, oh, man, we're not going to listen to that story. You got a woman in there doing this stuff? No way. But it was true. Why did Mary Magdalene get to see the Lord first and not any of the disciples? Because she had reached a higher level of maturity, which wasn't hard to do, than the disciples. She had reached the highest level of maturity of all these people. And therefore, she had the privilege of seeing the Lord first, not his mother. Mother didn't see him first, and she was still alive. It was Mary Magdalene that saw him first. So Mary, the mother of Jesus, she's not the mother of God. God doesn't have a mother. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was not at that higher level than Mary Magdalene. And, of course, we also know that the Roman centurion, when Christ said to the Roman centurion, remember he said, my son's ill. Christ said, I'll go with you. Oh, you don't need to go with me. Just give the word. You're God. And what did Jesus say? I have not seen this much faith rest of anybody in Israel at that time. And that was a Gentile. So God looks at the heart. Mary Magdalene was the one that knew the most Bible doctrine. That's why she got to see him first. And the first thing she did is she put the bear hug on him, which women will do. When women really like you, my wife always says they'll hit you. Kind of give you a hit. And she's telling that to my boys all the time. But no, they'll put a hug on you and you can't even get loose. They don't want to let you go. And that's what Mary Magdalene did. Of course, you know what the Lord said. He said, Gune, let go of me. The mission's not done yet. I've got to ascend. She didn't want him to go anywhere. I've got you. I'm not letting you go. And that's what a woman in love will do. You're not leaving anywhere. You're staying right here with me. And of course, the Lord said, no, I've got to ascend. You know, I've got other things to do. So you got to let go of me. Again, she was letting her emotion short-circuit the Bible doctrine in her brain. She knew he had to go to third heaven. I mean, she had listened to all these things. He's got to ascend to the Father. She didn't want him to ascend to the Father. Just like Peter earlier, Christ said, I'm going to die on the cross. I don't want you to die on the cross. I'll fight for you. And he meant it when he said it. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. You don't know what you're saying. You're letting your emotion overrule the Bible doctrine that you should apply to this situation. But this is natural for women. So she said, I held on to him and would not let him go. And so bring to the mother's house and the room of her who conceived me. So the strongest relationship you have before you get married is what? Your family, ideally. That's why it says, for this cause a man shall leave his mother and his father. Why does it say that? Because that's the strongest relationship, humanly speaking, you have before you get married. When you get married, that's the strongest relationship. It's no longer mommy and daddy anymore. It's the spouse. They have number one allegiance, not the parents anymore. You leave them and you form your own new allegiance to the spouse, and that's the way it is. So this is emphasizing this important principle of doctrine. Verse 5, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. So she is fantasizing here about going into the house of the mother that they're going to have relations here in the bed, into the room where she was conceived, because that's what happens when you're conceived. Conceived here is not give birth, but conceived. So that's obviously this is where the sex took place and biological life was created. She was conceived in this room on this particular bed, and she wants to do the same thing with her shepherd lover. She wants to be sexual relations with him in the house. And of course, that's her desire. Now, of course, if that's not your desire, then you probably shouldn't be getting married in the first place, because God invented sex as an expression of love between a male and a female in marriage. So she's saying, this is what I'd like to do as well. And that's not sinful at all. So she says, verse six, we skip, it's almost like a play here. This, you know, we're going off to a different scene. We got Solomon's wedding day. What is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant? Behold, is the traveling coach of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. This is his personal bodyguard, and these are the best and the strongest of his soldiers. And usually that all matched them in height. They get the tallest people they possibly could to intimidate everybody. So you'd pick out all the 6'5" people, or 6'6", and you get everybody in the range of 6'5" to 6'6", or even 6'7" if you can find them, or 6'8", and you make them as tall as possible, as strong as possible, and you train the living daylights out of these people, make sure that they're all sterling in terms of fighting and courage and doing their duty, and it would look they'd look very scary to people. That would be your personal bodyguard, the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. So their job is to keep anything and everything away from Solomon, and that's what they would do. Verse 9, King Solomon has made for himself a cedar chair from the timber of Lebanon. So he doesn't even have a Jewish chariot. He's got a foreign-made job car. I like to buy American products, but Solomon, of course, recognized that these chariots are superior than the products made in his own country. So he's got the best of the best. He has made its post of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Why the daughters of Jerusalem? Because they'd get small kids, usually small, in this case, I guess, girls, but with small hands to do all the intricate sewing and needlework and putting little beads and all sorts of stuff in there. Verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. So Solomon is anticipating his wedding day, what it's going to look like. He's going to come in with his chariot, with his mighty men and all the entourage, and he's going to have this wonderful wedding with this Shulamite woman. Chapter 4, how beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats. I don't know if you want to say that to a girl today, but back then it was a wonderful thing to say. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes. This is a very young sheep. And so, in other words, they got all their teeth, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and are not and not one among them has lost her young. In other words, she's got all her teeth, and all of them are twins. What are twins? They look identical. So sometimes you see people with one tooth is black and one tooth is kind of crooked, and this, that, the other, they need braces. Well, all of her teeth apparently are just like piano keys. They're all perfectly formed and perfectly matched, same color, the right size, you know, no overbite, no underbite, doesn't need braces. They're all perfectly set. Verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. So the lips are like a scarlet thread. Again, that's just an indication that they're very attractive, and the mouth is well set on the face. Your temples are like a slice of a pomegranate behind your veil. So her forehead is not too big and not too small, not too skinny and not too wide, and so it's just perfectly matched. Verse 4, your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. David built for himself a tower, and this was outside of his home. Solomon built a gigantic house for himself, but the first one was the Tower of David, and they think they've discovered this where David's tower was. It was his living quarters. It was a big tower where you could stand out and look over things. That's probably where he was standing out when he saw Bathsheba taking a shower on top of one of the houses. Verse 5, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feeds among the lilies. Again, we got the twins things here. Now, you know, that which tells you that the breasts are evenly matched. Just like teeth, some women apparently have one breast that's larger than the other breast. And one that might go north and one goes south, I don't know. Anyway, these are evenly matched, and they're whatever is attractive to Solomon. He equates those to two fawns, which means they're, you know, they're still, I don't know what words I want to use without, still whatever they are. They're not old breasts, they're new breasts, let me just say that. And they're perfectly matched. And then six. Again, men have different things about female pulchritude that they enjoy. Some men like the women's legs, some men like women's breasts, some men like this, that, and the other thing. And this is apparently the type of woman that is very attractive to him. And so he's letting us know that in verse 5. Verse 6, until the cool of the day, when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to be to the mountain of mirth and to the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. So she has no blemish that he can see. There's no like 15 moles, or there's no type of sores on her body or her face, or her skin is flawless, and so he is indicating that's another thing that attracts him about her complexion. And I know that some, you know, people have complexion problems. You've seen them, you know, with this, that, and the other thing. Apparently she didn't have those problems. Verse 8, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down from the summit of Amana, from the mountain, so from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. So he calls her a sister, which indicates, of course, he has this compatibility with her. He's reached the compatibility stage. It's not his sister. This is the Shulamite woman. But he understands that bond between a brother and a sister when they grow up together. And apparently he had sisters, obviously. And so he is not just blown away by her physical attraction, what we just described, but he also finds that he has a deep attraction to her, to want to protect her, to take care of her, to watch over her as you would a sister. And so you would not let anybody insult your sister or do anything bad to your sister, and that's why I use the word sister here. But he also says, my bride. So he wants to marry her. He's proposed to her, whatever that was in the ancient world. He wants her to be the bride. And, of course, this is part of love, the attraction thing here. His heart beats faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. Verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. So, he's imagining, of course, again, that her love is going to be fantastic. She's going to give him all of her love, and that's what he wants. This is what he wants. He wants a woman that will give him everything that a man wants in terms of the marriage factor. Verse 11, your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked, a spring sealed up. She's a virgin. And so he indicates that she's been locked up and she has guarded herself for the man that she would marry. And a spring is sealed up. That's her. All her love has not been tasted by someone else. The spring hasn't been drunk from by someone else. It's all sealed up and he's going to drink from it. 8:13, your shoots are like your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates. Pomegranate is a fruit that was very popular in the ancient world. We still have it today. With choice fruits, henna, with nard plants, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon. These are spices, things that smell very nice. With all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and alloys, alloys, along with all the finest spices. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, and streams flowing from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south. Make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. And his garden here is his garden. He wants her to come into his garden and eat all the choice fruits, of course, which is him. That's what he's longing and he's desiring to occur here. Chapter 5. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh along with my balsam. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers. I was asleep, but my heart was awake. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. So he is now indicating having his own little dream here. His heart's always on alert, but he's asleep. A voice, my beloved, was knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is drenched with dew, my locks with the damp of the night. So he's dreaming intensely, and he's actually sweating. He's dreaming so intensely. If you've ever had a dream where you kind of perspire a lot, it means it's a very intense dream. So he's having a very intense dream about this woman. 3, I've taken off my dress. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I dirty them again? Usually when you went to bed, you would wash your feet because, again, you're walking around with some type of slippers or bare feet, and it's hard to keep the floors clean. And if you're walking around all day long, your feet get dirty, so you'd wash the feet before you got into the sheets so they wouldn't get all stinky again. Verse 4, my beloved extended his hand through the opening, and my feelings were aroused for him. I rose to open my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, and my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and had gone. My heart went out to him as he spoke. I searched for him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer me. So here we have Solomon's torment, but we also have the woman's torment. She is also having her own dreams, but her dreams are not about Solomon. She is dreaming about, just as intensely as Solomon is dreaming about her, she's dreaming about the shepherd lover. And she's calling, remember, the same dialogue we have with the watchman. We're going to get that in verse 7. Let's see. So we did verse 6, right? Yeah. I called him, but he did not answer me. The watchmen who made the rounds in the city found me. They struck me and wounded me. The guardsmen of the walls took away my shawl from me. I adjure you, O daughter of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick. What kind of beloved is your beloved, O most beautiful among women? What kind of beloved is your beloved, that thus you adjure us? So apparently, she's having this dream, but Solomon is also dreaming her dream. As he somehow is being keyed in that while he's dreaming about her, she's dreaming about him. And she has nothing to do with him. And then he is very concerned with his dream as well. So it's a dream within a dream. He's accurately interpreting what she's thinking in his own dream. So as he's looking for her, he picks up on the thought that she is out with the watchman looking for her husband or her lover, and he's dreaming that she gets killed in the process, when death, of course, means a bad thing in the dreams, and that it's, you know, once she's dead, he can't have her, nobody can have her, because she's been wounded. They struck me and wounded me in verse 7, and they take away the shawl from me. So she is being abused by the watchman. And so Solomon is seeing all these things in his own dream. Verse 10, my beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. So this again is an indication of this is what she is thinking. Again, not Solomon. Solomon is not the beloved here. It's the beloved is the shepherd lover. So whether she's dreaming this or Solomon is dreaming it in her dream, You can have it both ways. But we do know that this is her attitude, as we've seen throughout. She has nothing to do with Solomon. He wants everything to do with her, but she's always thinking about this other fellow. And if you've got a woman that you're dating that's always thinking about another fellow, it's time to do what? Yeah. Bye-bye. Because you're just kidding yourself. My beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. So this is her shepherd lover. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates, and black as a raven. So the black of the raisin here is this. He has black hair, and he has the gold stuff here is just an indication that he is very well formed in her mind. He's got the nice features that she likes as well. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, and responded to their set and responded and reposed rather in their setting. His cheeks are like a bed of balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping with liquid mirth. His hands are rods of gold, set with beryl. This is a precious stone. His abdomen is carved ivory, must do a lot of sit-ups, inlaid with sapphires. His legs are pillars of alabaster, set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness, and he is wholly desirable. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. So she calls the beloved her friend, which means she is past the attractiveness stage. She's past the compatibility stage. That's the friendship thing, and she's in the rapport stage. How do you know she's in the rapport stage? Because she's got all this stuff about the head of gold, and he's like Lebanon, and all this stuff. That's a rapport stage. It's attractiveness and rapport. She thinks about him all the time. Now, he may not be the best looking among 10,000, but to her, he's the best looking among 10,000. I think they had a song during the 60s about that in Motown Records. My Guy or something? Yeah, I think so. Anyway, that's her attitude, and she calls this person a friend. Now, Solomon calls her a sister. Your sister may not be your friend, but it's your sister, so you're going to protect her and take care of her, but you may not have that friendship relationship with your sister if you have a sister. Here, she has a friendship relationship with her shepherd lover. Chapter 6, where has my beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Now, this is from the shepherd lover. We've talked about the woman loving the shepherd lover. What's the shepherd lover's attitude towards the woman? And we're going to get that right here. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to his pasture. This is again, I'm sorry, this is still with the woman talking about where, it's talking about him. He is talking about her at the first place, and then she is talking about him. They both realize that they're separated from each other. So, the first line is, where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Which is talking about where is the shepherd lover? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? So here we have the daughters of Jerusalem, which is basically the crowd, saying, yes, we understand the concept of marriage, and this is the one you should marry, and we deem that this concept of marriage is correct. In verse 2, my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flocks in the gardens, and gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He who pastures his flock among the lilies, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awesome as an army with banners. Ancient world, the army would come out and have their big banners. You see them coming from a distance. It would look pretty awesome, with the flags waving and stuff, very attractive. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have confused me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost her young. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. She is her mother's only daughter. She is the pure child of the one who bore her. The maidens saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines also. The queens are the wives of Solomon. The concubines are his 300 women that aren't wives. And they agree, and they praise her, saying, "Who is this that grows like the dawn? As beautiful as the full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners. I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. Come back, O Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze at you. Why should you gaze at the Shulamite as at the dance of the two companies?" Now, the Shulamite is the woman. And they, of course, can't get enough of her. They don't want her to go. And if she is gone, they want to have her back immediately. So their position is that she's a wonderful thing along with Solomon. And at least they admit that she is this perfect catch. But we have to go. Chapter 7 is the admiration of the bridegroom, which I got myself ahead of myself in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is simply the description of this wonderful Shulamite woman. Verse 7, chapter 7. "How beautiful are your feet and sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your hips are like jewels, the work of the hands of an artist. Your navel is like a round goblet which never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is like a heap of wheat, fenced about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabim. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, which faces toward Damascus." Damascus is the capital of Syria, which is a very prosperous city at this time. "Your head crowns you like Carmel." Carmel was a gigantic mountain that everybody knew about. "And the flowing locks of your head are like purple threads. The king is captivated by your tresses. How beautiful and how delightful you are, my love, with all your charms. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit stalks. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, flowing gently through the lips of those who fall asleep. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the country. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early and go to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossoms have opened, and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes have given forth fragrance, and over our doors are all choice fruits, both new and old, which I have saved up for you, my beloved." And so this is the union that should be, and this is the union that's longed for by both the shepherd lover and the Shulamite woman. This is what they want to do, and so this is their imaginations of what they're anticipating. And of course, in the context of marriage, this would be their wedding night, that they would do these wonderful things. In chapter 8, we have, "Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breast. If I found you outdoors, I would kiss you. No one would despise me either. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, who used to instruct me." Again, this is her speaking about her lover is not Solomon, but the shepherd lover. And she talks about her mother who used to instruct me. That's divine institution number three. Where did she learn all this stuff? Who was her instructor? Her mother. The mother apparently was the major disciplinarian. Doesn't mention the father, but it mentions the mother, and who used to instruct me. Now she doesn't need instruction because she's a full-grown woman. She's got all this stuff down. But when she was a girl, she had to be taught about these things, about the divine institutions, about what marriage is all about, what family is all about, and all these other topics. So she had parents that taught her Bible doctrine and all three categories of truth. And she took it in. "I would give you spice wine to drink from the juice of my pomegranates. Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." Same concept we saw earlier when she's dreaming about the shepherd lover. She wants to have sex with him, which is a very natural thing. Again, sex and marriage is God designed it. Adam and Eve had a lot of sex in the garden before they fell. We don't know how much, but I'm sure it was a lot. That was a way that they express their desires and love towards each other. Verse 4, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. The she here is her. The love, of course, let him sleep, and until I please, I'm the one that will set the pace here. 5, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Beneath the apple tree I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Let me put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. It flashes, its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. This is an interesting passage. We saw the same parallel in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians. So it says, let me put me like a seal over your heart. In other words, this woman is waiting even before she met her husband, which is going to be the shepherd lover. It was a seal over her heart. She was going to wait until she got the man that God had designed for her. Or she get the idea that there was a man that God had designed for her. Her mother had instructed her in these Bible doctrines. So she knew that somewhere out there, God's designed somebody for me. Do I want a cheap substitute? And God might have thrown cheap substitutes in front of her many times. But she would do the checklist, attractiveness, compatibility, rapport. And she would say, well, they got so far, but that's about as far as they got. So the answer is no. And so she was waiting for that particular one that would come along at some point. She didn't know when, but she was waiting. And so that's the seal over your heart. It's a seal. It's sealed it up. She's got norms and standards, and that seal will not be broken except by the right person. Set a seal on your arm. And the same concept. The arm is your doing things. The heart is your determination that I have this concept of Bible doctrine in my brain, and the arm is I will follow it. A lot of people understand the concept, but they don't follow it. Saturday night comes along, I have a couple of drinks, and away you go. So yes, I realize the concept, but my arm is just not following the concept. Then you rebound and try to move forward. But this particular one says, I've got the seal over the heart, understand the Bible doctrine, and it's a seal on my arm. I'm not going to do it. I will not fall to these temptations. And then it says, for love is as strong as death. Yes, till death do us part, as part of the Anglo-Saxon marriage ceremony. Because of death, you will part. And that's physical death. And death is pretty strong. And love is pretty strong. In fact, people actually kill themselves because their spouse or their lover left them. You've seen this stuff. People actually commit suicide because I'll never love again. Now you've seen the Dear John, the Dear Jane, I'll never love again. They jump off a building. Well, they kill themselves. So this thing called love was as strong as death. And if you don't have Bible doctrine in your soul, when it hits you with the Dear Jane or the Dear John, what are you going to do? Well, you might get despondent to a degree, but some people actually kill themselves. And this happens, and it happens, probably happened today while we're speaking. Somewhere in the United States, somebody's probably going to kill themselves because they got dumped. Or they might kill the person that dumped them and then kill themselves. Now, that happens too quite often. If you deal with the law, you'll bump into these cases. I always say it's better if they had the murder-suicide. It's better if you do the suicide first, buddy, and not murder other people. So it is a strong emotion. And jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Sheol is the Hebrew word for Hades, which is our English word equivalent is hell. So Sheol here is basically when you die. When you die in the Old Testament, Sheol was a compartment, of course, a large compartment. Sheol has compartments within it. It's a large place. Or it might be a small place. Because how big is a human soul? Don't know. Sheol could be as big as a quarter. It's located under the earth. But how big is a human soul? That's the question. The soul is real but immaterial. The body's real and material, but the soul is real and immaterial. But in the hell or Sheol or Hades, it has compartments. For the unbeliever, they go to a compartment called torments. For the believer, they go to a compartment called paradise or Abraham's bosom. That's in the Old Testament. Today, when you die, you don't go to Sheol. You go directly to the third heaven outside the universe, and you're face-to-face with the Lord. In a place where there's no more tears, no more sorrow, no more pain. The old things have passed away. You don't have a resurrection body, but you're waiting for the resurrection body, which you will get at the rapture. You will get your resurrection body at the rapture. You'll be joined by believers that are alive at the time. That number at that time could be very, very, very small of believers on the face of the planet at that time. Then you'll get your resurrection body. But in the Old Testament, they all went down to Sheol. Everybody, believers and unbelievers, just went to different compartments. That's why we have to understand the Bible in the context which is written. Jealousy is a horrible sin. We've got a whole thing on judging in your book. And jealousy was so bad and devastating to civil society that they had a separate rebound ritual for the sin of jealousy in the Old Testament. That's how devastating it is. And jealousy, of course, the kissing cousin. Where does jealousy spring from? Arrogance. Arrogance. That's where jealousy comes from. You're jealous of something or somebody else because you are an arrogant person. You're hypersensitive about yourself. Everything's about you, and therefore you're jealous, and that is a severe sin, and it will motivate murder, it'll motivate gossip and slander and all sorts of things, because you're jealous. Somebody else got that, I should have it. I hate them. It's flashes or flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. So that's how this is an equivalent of how devastating it is. And if you get hit by the flame of the Lord, well, that's the sin unto death for the believer. You're wiped out. And the flame of the Lord, of course, is absolute perfection. And it will gobble up jealousy. It'll take care of it. Jealousy will destroy itself. Arrogance goes before a fall. Jealousy goes before a fall. What's the fall? Well, self-destruction of yourself. And it will occur. Verse 7, many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. And that's true. Love, true love between a man and a woman, that's the context here. There's different types of love, but this would be category 2 love. Remember the doctrine of love in your book. Category 1 is love for God. God loves you with a maximum love, but the issue is, do you as a believer love God? And the answer for most believers is no, because they don't know anything about God. But you, of course, love God, because the more you know about God, the more you can actually love him and not lie when you say, I love Jesus. And so you have category 1 love, you have category 2 love between a man and a woman in marriage. Category 3 love is friendship. Friendship between with other members of the human race. And the category 4 love, that's the problem-solving device, the preeminent one, which is impersonal love. They hate you, you don't hate back. All the integrity is in your soul. So it doesn't matter how the object treats you, you don't respond in kind because you're the subject. And it's, I love the object is insignificant. And that is a wonderful problem-solving device. That's category 4 love, which, of course, nobody knows about that at all. At all. But that's the problem-solving device. So here we have category number 2 is what they're talking about. If you've got that love between a man and a woman in marriage that God has designed, many waters cannot quench love. Waters represent troubles. Water floods in, and the water here represents troubles. And the troubles, one of your troubles, if you got fire and the water puts the fire out and you're out on a camping trip, that's trouble. But water can wash the mudslides and all sorts of things. People in the ancient world knew about flash floods and floods. And so many waters cannot quench love, many problems. You can't put it out. Love can survive everything. Nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. Solomon would give all the riches of his house if he could get this woman. But it's not going to work. Love doesn't care about all the riches of his house. Love cares about love. It's not impressed with riches. Now, a lot of women will marry these old buzzards. You've seen them. The sweet young thing is marrying some old dude that's in his 60s or 70s, got a lot of money, and she's like 20, and she's a hottie. You know, how's that happen? Well, we know how it happens. What's attractive to him is obvious. The attractive stage, that's it. Because he ain't got any compatibility with her. They listen to different music. She's listening to this, and he's like, remember this? And Frank Sinatra, who's that? Wow. But he's in the attractive stage, obviously. And she, of course, is looking for the money. That's all the BBD. She would be the type of woman that Solomon would say, come into the harem. I'm there, man. Let me kind of bring my mom with me, and you know, we're there. Let me pack my stuff up. I'll be there in a New York second. So In this case, though, this is a point of doctrine that Solomon is writing here, and he would give everything for love. Absolutely. But you can't buy it. You cannot buy true love. Oh, you can buy love. Men do it all the time, but it's not true love. They're buying sex, they're not buying love. And sex, of course, is a biological urge. It's not a necessity, it's an urge. You'll live, you won't die. So it says, where are we? Yeah, it would be utterly despised, verse 7. Verse 8, we have a little sister, and she has no breast. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? Again, this talks about the divine institutions, and this is number 3, the family, because when she's in the family, there's some point when all women are just little girls. And what do you do with little girls? Well, you train them. And remember, she said, my mother instructed me. And so that's in chapter 8, verse 2. We already looked at that. And so when she was young, she was trained. We know in the New Testament also, it says older women, you should instruct the younger women in the local churches they had there on how to be a good mother, wife, etc., etc. You don't fill their head with the nonsense of we are the woman, that we are the equality movement, the women's rights movement, and all this stuff. We don't need a man, and just because this man is evil, they're all evil. No, you tell them the deal. You tell them exactly what you were designed to do. Now, not all women are designed to get married. If you don't want to get married, don't get married. But if you do get married, see, these older women would instruct them that the man is the head of the household, not you. And if you think you are, you're an arrogant SOB, and you're going to make somebody extremely miserable when you do marry them. You might turn them into a mouse. Yes, dear. It's like, are you a man or a mouse? And the man would say, pass the cheese, please. And see, what she thinks she wanted is a man she could rule, she despises him because she's not wired to be a ruler over a man. She's wired to have a man protect her and to be a man. But we have a culture today that teaches men to be metro sex or whatever the hell they call it, to be wimps, to walk around with earrings in their ears and just, you know, they're I don't want to say the bad words, but I can string out a whole bunch of bad words. They're despicable. And any woman that's got any brains, they want nothing to do with these losers. They're losers. And so women are sold a bill of good that that's the way it should be. We are women. We are equal to men. Well, as I said before, you're wired differently. Of course you're equal to men in terms of mentality, but there's a system of authority that God has set up called the divine institutions. And your role is not in marriage to be the head of the household. And that's just the way it is. That's what the Bible says. Now, that's not what many people in society say, but you got to make a choice. Somebody's wrong. I got you. Either I'm wrong because I'm telling you the Bible, or the Bible's wrong because it's in black and white, or they're wrong. They both can't be right. So you decide under divine institution number 1, which side of the fence do you want to line up on, ladies? So who's going to teach these women this stuff? Because society teaches you a lie. And I know many women that are in their 40s that bought the lie, and they're miserable, absolutely miserable. And if you are 40 and a male or 50 and you're dating, man, you don't want to get anywhere near them because they are bitter because they've seen time has passed them by. And they bought it. And they've had a wonderful career, and they're totally miserable. And their career didn't even satisfy them because they had a yearning for something that could not be filled, a void. And all the women live stuff didn't fill it up at all. And so they get into other miserable women, and they form little things. They go off the communes and consort with all sorts of weird stuff. So I would always just kind of give them a wide berth whenever I ran into some of these people in my younger days. I have nothing to do with them at all. Now, of course, men have responsibilities too, but this is not, we're not talking about men because a man, of course, in many ways has a greater burden than a woman in a marriage because he is supposed to put the woman above himself. So she's supposed to be, the man's the ruler of the house, but he has to treat her better than he treats himself. So which role would you rather have? If you had, God said, you want to be born a man or a woman? Which one do you want? Well, if I'm wired to be a man, I'd rather be a man. If I'm wired to be a woman, I'd rather be a woman. And if I got wiring problems, then you got other issues, dude. But And some people do have wiring problems in their whole system, and they need special treatment. What they need is a lot of Bible doctrine, a whole lot of Bible doctrine, because people have different trends in their old sin nature. And they might have a trend towards being this or that, the other thing. Well, then just don't do it. You still have volition. You don't have to give in to the, if you've got a loose wire somewhere where you're born with, you know, with things that don't quite line up with what they should, well, then don't give in to it. You can rewire yourself. It can be done. So in any event, we have this concept here of the little girls have to be taught, because it's not natural for the old sin nature to be under authority. We all have an old sin nature. Nobody likes authority. Nobody likes being told what the boss can tell me to do something. I don't care if you're male or female. I don't want to do it. That's your natural inclinations. Who is he to tell me? Or who is she to tell me? Because males, you can have a female boss. Yeah, who is she to tell me? Well, you know, she'd tell you what to do or where to go. You're not married to her. You have no authority over a female boss. She has complete authority over you. If you don't like it, then quit and find somebody else to make a disaster of their business because you're arrogant. Verse 9, if she has a wall, if she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar. So in other words, there's just an idiom for them protecting these people. Just an idiom for protecting these people and let them do what they have to do. Verse 10, I was a wall and my breasts were like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace. So her, she grew up and her breasts became like towers. This doesn't mean she's particularly a woman that has big breasts, but it just means that she has now grown up. And of course, in his eyes, this is the woman that he's going to link up with. And then verse 11, we have Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. And then my very own vineyard is at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. O you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So here, Solomon has this gigantic, fantastic vineyard and all the wonderful things he has, but she apparently was let loose by Solomon, and we forgot to mention that earlier when it says, come back, come back. That's chapter 6, verse 13. She actually left. We don't have all the details, but she did leave. Solomon let her go because he at least, remember, he's the smartest man that ever lived with the IQ. When he had that dream about her not wanting him, and wanting this other man, he was smart enough to know that even though this is the woman I desire above all things, I've got to let her go. And he did let her go. And we can conclude, of course, where does she go? Well, we know that the shepherd lover loved her, and she loved the shepherd lover, and they were anticipating having wonderful sex together in marriage, and she was ripe for marriage, and boom, that's exactly what they did. So when they did the come back, all the queens, all the concubines were very upset when she left. But Solomon, again, he's got conflicting things in him, but he's not a brute. He's not going to rape her. He's not going to take her against her will. Because all the women he had that were married, they didn't go against their will. Even the concubines, they all very gladly did these things. That's why he was trying to impress her. And that's what we had in the Song of Solomon. I'm impressing you with this and that and the other thing. She wasn't impressed. It was quite a shock to him because all the other females were extremely impressed. Because he could have, like his daddy did to Bathsheba, you're just coming to bed with me. He didn't do much to Bathsheba, remember? He says, get down there, get that naked woman, and bring her up here. And that was it. Had sex with her. Solomon didn't do that. Remember, he's the smartest man that ever lived. And he knew that you can't buy love. That's where we have this the discourse we covered about how strong love is. And the strong love was not her love for Solomon. It was her love for the Shulamite, is her love for the shepherd lover. She's a Shulamite woman, and vice versa. So Solomon recognized the concept of how strong love is. He let her go. All the girls wanted her back. He wanted her back, but he realized that this is not going to work. So at least he had the integrity and the wisdom, because he was the smartest man that ever lived. I can't buy her. She don't want me. She's not impressed with my wedding party, my chariots, my anything, my gold, my looks, nothing. She's pining every day. She's dreaming about this guy. She wants to go through the city looking for him. She hopes that he finds her. And she expressed this to Solomon. And he apparently dreamed about her dream, expressing these things. And we don't have this, but he apparently had a dialogue with her. What's up with this shepherd dude? Now, Solomon could also have done what to the shepherd dude? Kill him. He could have sent out his 60 mighty men, find this dude, and kill him. That's what his daddy did. Remember? Bathsheba already had a husband. Uriah the Hittite, a very noble man, had him murdered. Could Solomon have done that? Yes. Solomon knew all about Dad and what Dad had done. And he at least had the character not to do those things, because he realized that you can't buy love. It's stronger than death. Can't quench it. Many troubles, not going to stop it. I can't stop it. So he, God allowed him to see this woman, to almost have her, and then he had to let her go. And so we conclude here in verse 11 with Solomon has all these wonderful things. They're kind of recapping things. The wonderful vineyards and the thousands of shekels, all these things, and the 200 people there that are caring for the fruit. And then verse 13, O you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. 14. So let me hear it again. Solomon wants to hear. He wants this love. He wants all these things, but he never got it. Never got it. Verse 14, hurry, my beloved. Now, this is the last thing, and it refers to the Shulamite woman and the shepherd lover. Hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So there you go. I mean, she was hurrying back to him as soon as he let her go. And I'm sure Solomon probably gave her some some monetary reward to take with her. He dawned on him, and this is probably a turning point in him coming back to Bible doctrine, if I had to speculate. He probably met this woman in his 50s or, somewhere at that point because remember, he's already had all these women. We already saw all the queens, all the concubines. So this is later in his life when he met the girl. He said, this is the one. And when it was revealed to him that, dude, you ain't getting her, that he let her go. I'm sure he gave her a cash prize so they could go be like a gazelle and a young stag. You got the gazelle and the young stag, gazelle and a stag. And they're going to go off on the mountains of spices and go off into Never Never Land and have a wonderful marriage, which they did. But I would say this is the turning point, because we know in the book of Ecclesiastes that he said, I've gone back to Bible doctrine. This is the last straw. Because what will get you, when you're on a reversionistic course and you're going down, 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 you can crash and burn, die to sin unto death. But this apparently turned Solomon around. He saw this woman here, and I'm drawing up a nice little woman. I won't draw any boobs on her so people don't think I'm a weirdo. But he saw this woman, and that was a slap in his face. This was the divine discipline that turned him around, because this is what all he ever wanted was this. Remember, he said, who will give what they can for love, all the riches? Well, he would. And so he was allowed to almost have it in your hand and, dude, this is the one you could have had, but you ain't getting it. So when he rebounded, he let her go to the shepherd lover, didn't kill the shepherd lover, gave her a cash award, I'm sure, because this kind of indicates verse 11 that he's talking about this vineyard and the caretakers. Perhaps this might be his wedding gift to her. Who knows? It's just not clear. It could either be just a recap of his wealth, or it could be, in fact, the stuff that he gave to her on the way out the door. I like to think this is the stuff he gave to her. I'm going to give you a good cash award for you and your shepherd lover, and enjoy your life. So let's say that that's what it is. But we do know that he's at rock bottom. So when he hit this and he saw this, he said, there's only one thing left for me to do. I either kill myself or I get back with Bible doctrine. And that's what he did. He rebounded many times in the book of Ecclesiastes, but he would never do part two, which is, I'm going to do a crash course now for Bible doctrine. to re-put all these things into my soul that have been washed out. I'm going to relearn the stuff I forgot, and I'm going to learn new things, and then I'm going to start teaching. And so he wrote the Song of Solomon book, I would say, I don't know if he wrote it after Ecclesiastics, probably after Ecclesiastics, but it's a retrospective activity, and this, of course, is the thing that turned him around. It turned him around. What turned his daddy around? His daddy was in the same boat, remember? After Operation Bathsheba, he was out of fellowship for almost a year. The longest time he was ever out of fellowship was Operation Bathsheba. And what turned him around was a prophet came in and said, hey, remember, I'll tell him a little story. There was a rich man and a poor man. The rich man had all sorts of sheep and everything else. The poor man had one little lamb that they dearly loved. They brought it in their house, etc., etc. And then the rich man had guests, so he sent people over to take the one little lamb and slaughter it for the dinner. And then they questioned to King David, what should be done with the man that stole the little lamb from the poor man? And Solomon said, well, he announced the penalty, which was, you know, 10 times this, repay him this, and death penalty, a whole 9 yards. And then the prophet pointed at King David and said, you are the man that got him. That's what turned him around, because he had all these women, David did, not as many as Solomon, all these hotties, concubines and wives, and yet he took the little lamb from his noble captain, Uri the Hittite. He did it. And that's what turned him around. And then David rebounded and got back to Bible doctrine, plus a little bit of divine discipline, because David describes his physical condition. Can't sleep, can't eat, insomnia, upset stomach, psychosis. Same thing Solomon was describing in Ecclesiastics. Man, I'm all tore up. You know, physically, mentally, I just can't take this shit anymore. And then, of course, when he saw this Shulamite woman, he probably had a kick of adrenaline. Oh, my golly, there she is. This will solve all my problems. And God, you know, had that little worm on the fishing hook there and allowed Solomon to dangle it in front of Solomon, but he wasn't going to get her. She had nothing to do with him. She'd already been reassigned to another man. Could have had her, but you didn't get her. But she did serve a purpose. She slapped him upside the head, and he realized, I've got to rebound and start learning Bible doctrine. And that is the story of the Song of Solomon in 2 hours. It's probably our shortest Bible lesson, but since we have spent almost 2 full hours on this doctrine, it's a wonderful story. And Solomon, of course, made the right decision. He did the right things by this woman, and it caused him, and God knew that Solomon, in his volition, wanted to get back to Bible doctrine. And so God used this divine discipline to him, the thing he wanted most, to jolt him. And it did jolt him. It worked. It worked. Because otherwise, Solomon would have died the sin unto death. He was on his way down. He was on his way down and out, and we see that in Ecclesiastics. This turned him around. And God knows what will turn you around as well, what will turn me around. He knows exactly where to put the knife in your side and turn it. And then you either got to say, I got the message, Lord, thank you, I will do what you tell me to do, or you just simply die, the sin unto death, and go to heaven. Because all of this, our testimony is going to be, we were very positive to doctrine, then we turned away, and then we came back. Oh, me? Yeah, you. That's all of us. With her head bowed, her eyes closed, Father, we thank you for the privilege of studying your holy word. We pray that God, the Holy Spirit, will challenge us by these wonderful doctrines that you have given to us, that we may grow in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, as you have commanded us to do. We know that you have provided for us blessings beyond our imagination in time and eternity. More importantly, you have provided us the capacity to enjoy these things. Challenge us to take hold of our spiritual blessings and to trust in you, because you have patterned out all these things for us on our lives. In Christ's name, amen.